welcome to this week's episode of Khaki Malarkey. Today, we are joined by the wonderful historian, Tessa Dunlop, to talk about her brand new book, Army Girls.
Tessa, the first question we ask all of our guests is, can you summarise your book in 30 seconds?
Yes, big ask. It is. I'm going to go for it. Yeah. It is the testimony, the memories and the stories of 17 women sitting on the precipice of life in the middle of a pandemic, looking back at an arguably bigger, certainly much longer national crisis, which defined their young lives, the Second World War, when they were the first generation to be asked to serve king and country in military uniform.
Superb. Love it. Nailed it.
27 seconds. You've nailed it.
I switched to like a I can't see my seconds going round now.
I've got the seconds.
Well, I used to do live radio for 15 years. I did any history, so I can talk to time.
Nailed it.
Lovely.
Fantastic.
So, I mean, I'm sure it's no secret to anyone on my Twitter or on this podcast that one of my favourite books of all time is your last book, Bletchley Girls. And one of the reasons that I loved it so much is because you can really tell what a beautiful relationship you built with the women whose stories you were telling. And I think that makes such a big impact, and it's such a beautiful read. And I love every single one of those.
Oh, well, you'll want to hear then, but you're not meant, it's a bit like being a teacher. In fact, that was my first book, the middle one, Century Girls. Yes, so there's no reason why you should know. But funnily enough, it's been a learning curve. So Bletchley Girls, in some ways I look back and cringe because it was like my literary nursery step. Do you know what I mean? I was learning what I did. And then with Century Girls, I kind of felt I hit the exact right formula where I had six women and it was enough to get really intimate with them and to properly dig into their lives and to really feel I was looking after them as well. This project, Army Girls, again, like Bletchley, I needed enough women to be able to tell the story of a big organisation. ATS was hugely diverse. There was lots of different experiences within it. Ditto Bletchley Park. But the problem with that is, how do you ask a reader to follow the lives of 17 women, which is what Army Girls are for?
Yeah.
And as a result, I did it differently from Bletchley. Bletchley, I started the book, you follow all 15 women from beginning to end. Yeah. And I thought it was too much to expect of readers to know who they all were. So with Army Girls, I pick a couple and we start the book with them. And I keep some of them throughout the whole book, but others I just do a chapter on. So I mix it up a bit so you don't have to remember who they are all the time. But on a sort of pastoral level, I found it really challenging at the end of last year when it was like the perfect storm of some of my favourite Bletchley girls dying, not COVID, but loneliness didn't help in lockdown. Some of my Century girls dying, and at the same time as several of the Army girls feeling really like they needed me, and I was doing press with a lot of them, those who were healthy, and some of them also died, and those families need pastoral help, and there just wasn't enough of me. It was like some kind of, I felt like I was in some weird dystopian movie where it was all about, kind of really was end of life stuff, you know. I was in this war of And I felt I was constantly letting people down, like, oh my God, I haven't spoken to Anne today. And also you can't just call them. Some of them are very deaf. You have to go in and, Anne, a century ago, she died aged 107 and a half in December. She was, she remembered the end of World War One. She remembered those, you know, those thick fabric Union Jacks you get. She remembered them being laid out on the beach edge in her Buckinghamshire garden in 1918. The first ever armistice. Isn't it extraordinary? And so she was very precious to me, and she'd been in this awful care home. They were like back in prisons almost. It was like worse than the war. They couldn't get to them. So that, anyway, I diverged, but it's all part of one because they kind of fed into each other. And in fact, if you read Bletchley Girls, one of the women in Bletchley Girls, and I called her Charlotte in Bletchley Girls, weirdly, because that's her writer's name. She's like Madonna. But she's the only woman who also crossed into Army Girls, because she was a very rare case where she served in the ATS, the Auxiliary Territorial Service, and she also was seconded to Bletchley Park. Most people at Bletchley were Wrens, but not Charlotte, who becomes Betty in my Army Girls book, because that's her. She's probably the most well-known extant veteran, and that's how she's known more commonly in the press. So I thought I'll call her my Betty this time. But in the Bletchley Girls book, there was another Betty. So to not confuse her, Charlotte, she's a very dear friend. She's very special. She's 98, and in fact, I've just been asked if I'll do. I'm not sure I should admit to this.
Go on, Tessa, give us an exclusive.
Well, anyway, when you are very famous, you have obituaries made about you before you die if you're old. I've done them before on Vera Lynn. So you prepare the obituary before the individual dies. Mm. And it means you can get some of the relevant people from their generation who, when they finally die, might not be around. And in fact, the Vera Lynn one, when she did die, I think it was it last year or the year before? I think it was 2020.
I think it was 2020.
So I had a Century girl and a Bletchley girl in that who have now passed.
Oh, amazing.
But so to catch their thoughts on this woman who they knew, obviously. So it's the same with, probably the world's most famous ATS girl. We're not allowed to talk about the eventuality that happens to every human being in the context of her. Let's just leave it really cryptically.
Okay.
Yeah. But I was thinking I'm going to ask Betty to partake in that because she reminds me of.
Yeah.
They both wear the same black court shoes with a heel.
Oh, I love it.
What is that about nonagenarians? Where you think you just want nice flat rubber soles? Those little black court shoes. You know, and then to not be able to cope with standing, you know, they have a little handbag, so they can't even have a proper Zimmer that will hold onto a two hands. You know, it's asking quite a lot. They only have like one stick, you know. standards.
Anyway. Was Betty at your National Army Museum? Was she one of the
ones? She was in red. She's got powder. She was very tired. She came and did a sleepover with me. So Betty's the one that was at Bletchley Park. And then she said, oh, it's rather Spartan conditions here. A bit like, she said, and I said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, thinking they weren't that bad where I live. And she said, it's okay, I'm used to the war. I thought, my God, is my house that bad? But if you think when you're 98, you're not used to, she's not used to stairs. Also, she has something to help her get in the bath. You know, nothing was kind of, you know, I realised it was a bit student-y, you know. Anyway, and then she had to drive back. She didn't drive back to Birmingham, but I got someone to drive her back. She was terribly car sick. So the whole thing really was a bit like a sort of military mission. People, you know, but that's why I found it really difficult. And I was going into this dystopian description of the end of last year, because actually, you know, very, very old people, they become closed in. They're not physically able in the same way that we are. Their senses are diminished, so you can't just, you know, call them up or Zoom them. They don't have the tech. So everything requires multi-layers of administration and that I found that quite challenging.
Yeah.
I think it's just incredible the work you've done so far, especially keeping these women and like letting future generations know about them.
Well, love it though. But there's a balance, Olivia, weirdly. There is a, like, because I sort of think, oh, I don't want to think they think I'm using them. But, you know, so you have to read it, you know, promoting my book. On the other hand, you know, we all like a bit of attention, and most of them are sitting there. It's pretty boring waiting for Godot. And that's what they'll say to me. You know, they're sitting in their chair. They've been locked up in the lockdown. And actually, we all love talking about ourselves, I think. That's a human condition. Most people do, especially things we're proud of. And especially, I think, it's wonderful to talk about your youth, to remember really that brightest, luminous. I often wonder, you know, it's in such stark and vivid terms for them. But I think our youth always is. And remember, these women came of age in uniform. And if you think you guys look really young, but remember, this time of your life, when it passes, there'll be no other time as vivid. Mm. Because it's when you're forming, when you're making, you're learning everything you're experiencing for the first time. And that ceases to be the case when you're in your 40s. I'm bored to death of my existence now.
Oh, let's go for drinks, Tessa. We'll have fun.
Yeah. But funnily enough, I remember when I went, I used to, my other great passion is Romania. And I remember, and I think it's partly about first experiences. So for these women, it was the first time they'd left home. It was the first time they'd worn uniform. It's the first time they'd earned money. It's the first time they had independence and responsibility. When I went to Romania just after the revolution in 1991, there was this really old woman on the train, no teeth, a bag of apples. You know, you can imagine it was like literally, it felt like it was, it almost seemed pre-war. And everything was always really dark at that time. And I had Murray mints in a bag, and I gave her a Murray mint, and I showed her how to unwrap it. And she put it in this terrible food, especially in the 80s in Romania, really terrible food. and she ate this Murray meal. She was definitely from the countryside, and her whole face just broke into this kind of ecstatic sensory grin. And I was like, oh my God, it was literally like giving a child a hot chocolate for the first time or something. Oh. So actually, I think it is possible to, you know, have those really intense moments. Just we're normally sated in terms of our experiences. You know, we've had the sex, we've had a job, we've bought a hat, you know, whatever, you've done all the tick for, if you're privileged Western, whatever. So it's harder. That's why people, when they get old, want to jump off a, you know, go hover gliding or on the bucket list swim with dolphins or something that ends up being totally disappointing anyway.
I was going to ask, when you're kind of talking to these women about their past, I think something that comes up, I mean, I've worked with oral history in the past, and something that quite often comes up as a bit of a warning is that people remember things so differently every time. Did you ever encounter any problems with stories that maybe overlapped?
And definitely. Not sure. Absolutely, definitely. Nanzo, who I really liked and still do, she's in a Star and Garter, the military look after their own nursing home. She's wonderful. And I particularly was gripped by her story in the beginning because she said to me, oh, I didn't really want to join the army. I had to be conscripted. You know, I was most annoyed. I had to give up my very good job and blah, blah. She's Scottish, she's Glaswegian, actually. She's, you know, and she was really annoyed. And she waited for her papers to arrive, like the conscription papers, because in 1941, obviously, conscription for women was
important. Yeah.
And all the other women in my book volunteered. Some of them, because they knew they were going to otherwise be conscripted, to give them more choice over the role they did in the war. And some of them, because they just wanted to be in the army. They wanted to do their bit to wear uniform, king and country, patriotism, blah, blah, blah. Not Nanza. She didn't need that guff. She was up for just staying where she was in her insurance firm. She loved her job. Then later, when she kind of got the drift that everyone was a bit pleased with this war story and everything, she goes on BBC Birmingham, which is now our local radio. And likewise, she did an interview with the Glasgow, and she was like, oh, no, I wanted to be in the war. And she kind of changed her story. And she wasn't lying. I don't think in her heart, it wasn't like a deliberate fib. It was kind of blurs a bit. And she was reliving it through the prism of all the commemoration that had gone on. How could you possibly not want to be part of this wonderful thing? You know, and actually the pitfalls of oral history are plenty, but the women gifted me amazingly, several of them, extraordinary personal archives, which were unbelievable. Like Martha, who I'm also hoping will take part in this significant program. She had amazing Lady Martha Bruce.
Oh, we've just clocked who it's for. Oh, okay.
Yes, you only just clocked. I wonder if any of the readers and listeners have done any better. Deary me, come on.
Hey, I've had a long day.
It's all right. Have you done any better than your hostess, Olivia? Anyway, Lady Martha Bruce was, because the ATS was predominantly more working class girls. The other two services, the WEF and the REN, sort of innovative and nice blue uniforms, and they tended to garner more of these sort of middle class girls. And the ATS riding description, but Lady Martha Bruce was a sort of class apart and had real friends and many landed friends. And she, early on, had obviously a military background, she joined the ATS. Why was I telling you about Martha? Can't remember. What was
her personal, one of the personal, like, documents.
Oh, yeah. So she had, I did a whole interview with her, and it was a little bit furry. She's 100. And then the next time I spoke to her, she said, I've been looking at my letters. I was like, oh, letters, Lady Martha, letters. Now you're talking. And her mother, the Countess of Elgin, sort of writing to her, it was really brilliant. And she did talk about how the Queen, who at that time was who we knew as the Queen Mother, obviously, and George VI, came to visit a gun site, because the girls obviously operating behind the guns. They weren't allowed to fire the guns, goodness no, dear me, but they could operate all the machinery behind them. And she remembers that all the grass around all the predictor and the height finder and all these instruments to help bring down enemy raiders, they had to trim around them and whitewash them before the royal visit. Important that they all look sparkling. Yeah, it's quite sweet. So I got all these letters, and also I got letters. Maud, who died at Christmas, and I really love Maud, and she was one of my older ones. She had a lovely Brummie. Yeah. She was born in Stourbridge. God, she had such a gorgeous voice. Anyway, she again was chatting for ages, and then suddenly she pushed across this box full of letters, and they were love letters sent to her by Charlie. And Charlie was her true love. And she had met him. She worked in a military hospital, quite a famous one, actually. Oh my God, Holly something, and I've totally forgotten the name of it. Okay, wait, I'm coming back to that. In Birmingham, famous military hospital. Don't tell Maud, you can't. She passed at Christmas. They worked in this famous military hospital for soldiers, and there's a lot of pioneering work done for mental health and stuff, and what was not then, but now is called PTS, where she met Charlie, who was head of the medical depot. He then gets seconded into the commandos is the number three commander. So he's in the second wave, arriving at 7 a.m. and the first morning of D-Day landings, approximately. Actually, no, I think that's the first wave. The second wave is 9 a.m. And so she's like, and you don't know what's happening. It's not like he can text and say, here safely, darling. Or he doesn't speak like that anyway, our Charlie, but whatever. Because you only know, like, the lag time is 2 or 3 weeks, so you never know what's happening. And you just hear bits on the news. It's all heavily curated. Anyway, these incredible love letters come from Charlie from France, where he's fighting in that pocket in Normandy, and he's dreaming about Maud and her beauty and her lovely long eyelashes. And it was so beautiful, the letters. And it was quite poetic, talking about the moonlight and, you know, the sending off bombs. You know, oh, that was just really, it was one of my favourite and the easiest bit in the book to write, because I just copy out large clumps of the letter. They were so good.
Please tell me.
He survived the war. And then they get married in 44. It's a war, and comes back on leave, and in the December of 1944 they get married. So she immediately, being fertile Myrtle, because girls in that age got pregnant when they're biological, you know, the right biological point in there. So they all get pregnant immediately. They're all like, what? And of course, as soon as you get pregnant, you're demobbed. She was like, it was awful. I hated being out of the army. Yeah. She was like appalled by like being stuck at home with this baby. Can you imagine? Anyway, I'm now going to have to look up the name of that hospital in my book, ladies and gentlemen. Army Girls, ladies.
Army Girls.
That
would be so shameful. You talk among yourselves or ask me some more questions while I just look it up.
So, Tessa, what direction would you like to see like women / Second World War history take in like the next few years, perhaps? Is there anywhere you think it's lacking? I mean,
it's come, because it's come such a long way in the last 30 years.
I think it has. And I, funnily enough, I'm a different generation from you girls. I'm sitting between the two. And I think sometimes, I think the Second World was pretty well commemorated. I think it is. I don't think we can complain about that. And I think women have been finally recognised. In a way, part of the history is baked into the narrative, the military narrative, that women were always going to be remembered second in a war that heavily curated what the genders did, controlled what they did. So in war, men had to be masculine and women had to be feminine. Because otherwise, if women weren't feminine, what were men fighting for if it wasn't for the comely woman back at home in Hearth? And that meant that women couldn't be combatants. They had to remain non-combatants, with the very, very exceptional, you know, cases such as, I don't know, Violetta Stabo, for instance, with her Sten gun, you know, for example. But on the whole, 99% of the time, they were non-combatant. Now, what happens is, of course, that means men are killed more than women. Women were killed. More women were killed in the ATS alone than in the whole of the British services fighting in Afghanistan for 10 years, 700 and something. But they weren't killed in the same number. So 250,000 men died in Britain. Staggering to think 5 million German men died. Do you know what I mean? We always tell the war from, I would like more Eastern Front stories. I would like, my great passion is Romania. I'd like to see stories from countries like that where I think it's less well told. But that was just an aside. But I think almost that I would like to see more done on the Eastern Front now, I think, and shift our narrative a bit. I think Stalingrad, Stalingrad, but there was more to the Second World War than Stalingrad, do you know? Really? Anyway, back to the female narrative. Now that means that the men are heroes, and it's called the helix effect by academics, where in the narrative, women progress, they get more responsibility, they leave home, they're on, you know, they've improved their lot and they're being more recognized. But they're outstripped by men because men are the heroes. So it's like women take one step, men take two steps forward. And that means that, of course, then the men coming, returning from the home front, it's all about them, their heroism, the friends that they've lost. The Lady Martha Bruce's story really reminded me of that. Well, no, she didn't keep letters home in 1944-45. Well, why not? Nobody was interested in me anymore because my brother had been injured in the D-Day, you know, fighting in Normandy. So the hero brother, Andrew, was the story, do you see? And when she met the Queen, finally, for the Anna, because they knew each other, obviously, for the Anna centenary event, what are they talking about? Their own war story? No, they're talking about Andrew's injury. He should have had his leg off and he's, you know, had a bad limp ever since. So they're talking about the hero of the piece. And that explains why we're been so slow. And also the other thing is we start losing our empire from 48 onwards with India, etc. And then much more quickly in the 1960s. Well, what happens then? Britain needs to redefine itself and the 50s as well, as this, we're in the imperial abyss. Let's remember our brave Second World War. How do you remember something that's brave in the 50s and 60s? Make it really as masculine as you can. You know, it's all the big military films. They're all about, they've got a boy's own stuff about Brits being brave. that there's no space for a woman in that narrative. No. So I think there's a lot of understandable reasons. I'm not saying it's forgivable. I'm saying given the era that we're in, when the war's fought and the era when the war is first commemorated in the 50s and 60s. And I think it takes, you know, because actually the way in which we write history is history itself, isn't it? So Gibbons and then, you know, the 19th century, etc. So
I find it so strange, even since the days of kind of medieval ancient war, we've not lost that damsel in distress idea. You say that's so true in the Second World War. They have that, they have to be fighting for who? For femininity, for their women. And it's just so weird, isn't it, that that is the continuation.
Yeah, weird, except it's not weird entirely.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of maybe more annoying is the better word. It's like, why can't we shift that phrase, that damsel in distress phrase? Why is that never going to
happen? I think it has been shifted quite quickly in the last few years, but it's taken a hell of a long time. That's what's extraordinary.
A big lead up, yeah.
A big lead up. And, it was until women could control their biology, it weren't ever going to happen. Yeah. Really interesting question Betty put to me. Betty, who I knew from Bletchley Girls, and I've now got to know really, really well, obviously, because we've known each other for years. And she wants to be, she's lovely, Betty, and she's a real people pleaser. And she is pretty contemporary for a 98-year-old. And so she's heavily involved still in military organisations and so forth. And she's a good friend with former Colonel Ali Brown. He's won an OBE and, you know, was in the operational area of the Gulf and Kosovo. And then Betty once said to me, she said, it's just the thing is, she said, I'm all for women in the army and being on the front line. But how do they manage when they have their period? Betty, here's a thing. It's called the contraceptive pill. She had really such bad heavy periods. She had, because there was no pain relief. You know, some girls are really badly affected by heavy menstruation. And of course, and she was once put on a charge because she fainted with a really heavy period. Now, of course, you can solve that with the contraceptive pill and with pain relief and with all sorts of things nowadays. Yeah. It just wasn't, that sort of stuff wasn't available. Now, if you can't control that end, you also can't control conception, can you? So how can you rely on someone that might get pregnant at any moment if they're married? Because of course, people never had sex out of a marriage. Of course they did. They were immediately struck off.
Of course not.
A man, and that was a great part of my book, because the whole kind of Me Too thing, these pesterous men. And it was all down. But you can't expect a hero who's about to lose his life not to want to poke things, really, can you? So it's all down to the girls. All the onus is on the women to remain Virgo and tacto. Do you see, the onus is totally flipped now. It's very much, you know, God, men, bloody well behave yourselves. Yeah. That narrative has been totally flipped on its head in a matter of a lifetime, in a lifetime. I'm still looking for the name of that hospital. I've just got to look up H in the index to find it. I'm so embarrassed. Maud will be turning in her grave. Wait, Maud. In the index, keep talking among yourselves. Say something else. I'm listening. I can do two things at once. I'm a woman.
Ask the...
well, women are fans of the... Exactly. And one thing
Holly Moore. Did I say Holly Moore? I found the name of it.
Hollymore.
No, you did. Hollymore Military Hospital. Hollymore. And it had pioneering techniques for PSD and so forth. It's got group therapies and stuff they pioneered.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Well, my next question to you is going to be, what has been the highlight of your career so far? I'm sure there's been many, but if you could pick out one that you thought, I was really bloody proud of that, then what would it be? You've had so many achievements, so many...
No, but don't you think proud is... But I think, do you know what? Let's discuss that word pride, because it comes up a lot in commemoration.
Yeah.
Especially in commemoration of war and stuff.
Mm.
And a lot of the women, Anne is, bless her, she's passed sadly, but I loved Anne. And she used the word pride. So I was really proud to be in that army. Really proud. And I said, let's break that apart, Anne. What do you mean by that? What do you mean? But explain it to my generation what it means. And it was about this idea of a belonging that she partook in and served in well and achieved beyond expectations. She was promoted to junior commander, etc. And she was proud. Now, she said, but I'm often not proud of Britain today. She said, I don't know if I'd feel like that today. So it was this idea, it was like a perfect storm that brought together all the things she revered most. And she also came from a background which was kind of imperial, and they believed in service and public duty. And that was pride. And I felt I understood, and coming from her generation, I really understood that concept of pride. But I've never felt like, you know, when people go, oh, I'm proud he was my dad. But I think, well, I couldn't affect him being my dad.
Yeah.
You know, in a way. And also, I have an expectation that I should do okay. I've had a pretty good start in life. I'm born into a privileged country. I'm in a relatively, you know, I wasn't born at the, you know, I had parents who gave an SH1T. You know, I was sent to a nice little local primary school. You know, so I would expect that I would do okay, really. And I'm also ambitious. So I came in on the back of the second wave feminism, where I expected that I would achieve, irrespective of my gender. And what I find a bit nowadays, and I do it too, sometimes if you want a victim pile on Twitter, why not? But I think sometimes it's all woe is me as a woman. I think, it's partly because I know what came before us.
Yeah.
I'm like, actually, it might be harder sometimes for us. And I'm not saying that's forgivable, but I think given where we've come from, given the patriarchy, given the baked in institutional differences for millennia, I don't think it's been that bad for my generation. I'm a woman, I've got a womb. I think there are things that societally we've got totally wrong. And what's interesting is doing this book, this story reminded me of that. A woman's life is very long, but we're actually only bouncy and fertile. And feminism never talks about this because it hits the iceberg of infertility between the ages of 20 and 35. And I think we should be doing much, much more to protect women of that age, to give them a feeling of security. Instead, we're demanding of women that we weren't of these women. In some ways, they're amazing women. They are amazing, but their lives were delineated. They were simpler lives, the lives. I'm not saying they were better, but they were less complicated. You found your man, you had your baby. And then guess what? Over the age of 40, in their cases, they've had another 60 years to live. But I think what we do is we put life a bit on the never, never nowadays. And what's interesting about their story, one of their great fears, and it's in paragraph 11, is not getting pregnant. It's the great fear of my Sentry girls, my Bletchley girls, my Army girls. You can't control your biology. Yeah. Well, what we do is in the 60s, we work out how to control conception, and we put fertility on the never never. So if you're asking me as a 47-year-old, if I look at least one third of my female friends, they haven't had the family they thought they would have because they left it too late. And that is a narrative that we don't like talking about. And I'm somebody who had secondary infertility, and something that would have been so easy for me. It was like going through a war zone to get. Do you know? So I think that's not probably where you expected this conversation to go. But if we're talking about,
it's really interesting.
We're like, bang on, we get lost on kind of transgender and stuff that's quite niche. I think there's big stuff that's impacting the majority of women, and I can say it to you too because you're still young, but actually we're not saying to girls, there isn't equality, we've got a bloody womb. That's not equality, that's difference. So we need to treat that differently, and we need to have employers who've got such a progressive understanding. We need to have financial structures, I think, that assist women, because they've got to be in a place to be able to have a baby if they want to have a family, and most people do, by the time they're 34 latest. Our fertility starts declining at 28. And what's interesting is the women from the generations before us knew that. Phyllis, who was my Sentry girl, and she was born in India, and she always remembers, she wasn't part of the Raj. She was like what they would, there was a name for them. She wasn't Anglo-Indian, one up from that. It was really hierarchical, it was sick. She would have admitted that. She died only a couple of years ago, God bless her soul. She was like white, but born in India. Do you see? So that was like a class below those who could afford to send their children back to the metropolis. Anyway, she always says, oh, well, we always talked about the fishing fleet, the girls coming out in the fishing fleet. And I said, what's that, Phyllis? What the hell is the fishing fleet? She went, I can't believe you don't know what the fishing fleet is, Tessa. I said, no. She goes, well, all the girls are a bit long in the tooth. We're put on a fishing fleet to see if they could come out to Empire to find a man. And I was like, right. I said, all right, how old were they then? Thinking she was going to say 38. 28. Do you know what's interesting? Girls' natural fertility starts declining at 28.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's
And that's where the problem, can you believe it? It was like literally women's job. So again, going back to that wartime role, if you think, so what are we fighting for? We're fighting for this idea of Britain, the continuation of the race. These are racial times. You know, we are defined by our people. And that, I say, I use the word racial there in a curated fashion because it was different stratas of ideas of belonging. So on one hand, the British Empire included people of colour who were British. Now they would, obviously there was terrible anxiety about including black women, or at least bringing them over to Britain. And that was delayed as long as it could be by the War Office. There's one woman of colour in my book, still alive, aged 104.
Wow.
Lives in Barbados. She was hard to get to in a pandemic, I can tell you. but what you're doing is you're maintaining that idea of identity. So it's either supranational or it's racial, but the continuation of the species. In the Beveridge Report, 1942, you know, women are asked to breed for Britain after the war because we've lost men. We need to get yoked and do our duty. You know, this idea being that some kind of specious idea that British people are more valuable. Certainly they are on our small island than any other nationality. So if, so, and in the reports, you know, so if you're saying, it's on the one hand, you want girls to support your wartime effort. On the other hand, you want them to be future wives and mothers, bringing up the little ones, which is seen as soft and feminine, and also need to retain, they need to maintain their body and their femininity for that. They are, and one of the reports about whether women should be allowed to camp in tents or something, so they weren't allowed to be in tents, but of course, occasionally they were in tents, because, you know, that, you know, if you've got V1 rockets coming over and you need a gun sight impromptu, you need to stick up a tent. Anyway, but in the report, the parliamentary commission, they talk of bearing in mind that these are the nation's future wives and mothers, and we don't want a hardening of them.
Yeah.
So do you see why? So I think it's kind of a miracle we're at where we're at, which is not what feminists want to hear, because they want it faster, harder and sooner. I do too, but I think sometimes, I think some things sometimes get lost in the debate of getting that thing. We then, but we're not owning most, you know, so the fastest growing family size is a single child, but if you asked how many women have you asked if they wanted just one child, do you know anyone who's actively chosen to have one child? Not very many people do, actually. There's nothing wrong with one child, it's fine, it's very green and environmental. But I would suggest anecdotally, certainly, that it's not necessarily the choice that most women make, but it becomes a necessity if you and I'm someone who delayed childhood, partly because I was sacked and lost my job. We don't protect women. I don't feel so. It's anti-typical at the moment to talk about protecting women, but I actually want to see young women protected, not from bullets. They want to wear a flak jacket and get off to, they can now since 2018. They can be in any part of the British Armed Forces they want to be in. You know, they can do whatever they like, but I also want to see them get kind of protected, or at least recognize that they've got this situation, a biological time bomb that men don't have. Guess what? Willy Wonka carries on waving until he's 80 half the time. God damn it.
Oh my God, Tessa. I'm ready to revolt.
But can you see why I sometimes think, but I don't want to let down the sisterhood. I think we should be able to do whatever we want, but I'm saying we should be paid even better. Well, actually, that would stop people employing us, wouldn't it, if we were paid more than men? It's a difficult one, because you don't want to deter employers. Yeah. It's a trap. But I think I almost want positive discrimination. You know, mortgages should be easier for women of a child. Yeah. Stuff like that, I think. Yeah, why not?
Who knows?
Got another very loaded term there, positive discrimination.
Let's start the conversation. But the one interesting thing, so just really quickly, I also think what I need to, I mentioned the race question just briefly earlier, where I think that Britain is always hidden behind the fact that the Americans are segregated. Oh, not us! Moving along now. What's interesting is, and Anne was very interesting on this, very interesting. She worked in Italy, for example, and she worked, and they talked extensively about the race question stuff. She'd been born in Empire, so she's very aware of it. They didn't call the brownies in Burma, guess what? They called them the bluebirds. You know, so she had a heightened awareness of this, and she was very struck by often the Brits, who did a lot of pleasing and were sometimes, you know, came under the umbrella of the American military administration, just went along with stuff. And that was very much anecdotally what I got from Beryl as well, who was quite shocked about, you know, the way in which we just kind of, you know, and also the rules that she was given. She was given lectures on how to, there was a camp of black men were being stationed near to where her anti-aircraft gun sight was. And she remembered the way in which the officer sort of said, you know, that they're going to be coming, and they were given these lectures about the sort of comportment in front of these men, and they were sort of different, highlighting difference, you know, rather than common ground and similarities. But let's not pretend that, you know, it was just the Americans who were racist. And actually, in many instances, Britain went along with that segregated model. We didn't segregate, you know, our black ATS women, but we only let 100 of them into Britain. You know, so, and the rest, we were quite happy to have them work more locally within the empire. So that we kind of, we dodged that, if you like, that question to as much as we could. And the reason why we allowed those few black women, who we then photographed, to get the message that, hey, look, the daughters of the empire are being celebrated. So there's a real kind of double message going on there. The reason why was because the colonial office obviously was desperate to include women of colour, because they these restless especially in the Caribbean, you know, thrusting, talking about independence economically in the doldrums. You know, what they want to do is include them in the war to make them feel like they're part of this British project. And how can you say you're doing that if you're not letting women come across and serve? And so they're pushing, and the War Office is going, no. And then finally, the straw that breaks the camel's back, and this proves how supine we are, we just go along with it. When America joins the war, we need a contingent of ATS girls in the Pentagon and working in Washington. Well, who are the most geographically proximate and convenient to deploy? Those from the West Indies. And who are those that are conscripted? White women from the West Indies, because of the segregation issues in America. And therefore, at that point, if you're conscripting white ATS women in the West Indies, you've got to conscript black ones too. And those are the ones that come across to Britain. Not conscript, I'm using the wrong word there, conscript. Ask for volunteers. Sorry, totally wrong terminology.
Well, that's so interesting to hear, like, because you don't traditionally hear about that aspect of history. You know, it's a narrative that's very much kind of hushed away. So I think it's so important, Rachel, to kind of bring...
And I've got to say, as a white woman, I knew this from Century Girls, writing about a black woman, what I found hugely challenging. And in this instance, I let all the women see what I've written, if they're interested or they want to, before it goes to print, which has its own set of problems. And Olivia, who predominantly, she's 103, she's 104 now, I went predominantly through her daughter, and she was very concerned to make sure that the message was my mum did not have experienced any racism. She felt welcome, she felt loved, and I absolutely believe her. You know, there was, by restricting numbers, what the War Office did, and I think they totally overbaked that hand, but they made sure these women were revered as opposed to vilified. There was no fear of blood or whatever, you know, like there was just so few of them. They were exciting, there was a novelty aspect. And so they were really well, people were excited to meet these girls. They'd come over to serve. Also, there's nothing like a common enemy to reduce gender, class, race issues briefly. It doesn't get rid of them, but it certainly does soften some of the edges. Yeah. So over she comes and has this cracking time. What then happens is I say, well, I'll make sure that everyone knows that your mum, you know, felt it was very important and significant and time of her life, and she didn't experience racism. I said, but I can't erase the race narrative because it's there, it's baked in. You know, the War Office don't want women of colour. They're pretending it's because of the weather. I mean, come on. Right. Anyway, and then when the daughter reads the book, she's then suddenly worried that her mother looks naive. Do you see what I mean? The narrative, her narrative of going, hey, I'm having a great time compared to and then that is a hard one for me as a writer to resolve, especially when we're literally going to print the next day or something. So I think we did resolve it, it was fine, but I think these issues they're challenging. It's a challenge with oral history, it's a challenge when you're writing people's memory, but you're having to also weave in the bigger story, which they may not have even been aware of, or it wasn't significant to them at the time. Of course, Ina was very aware of it. She's a very bright woman. She goes on to be a lawyer. But during the war, that probably wasn't her primary focus. You know, when we're young and the primary focus is, you know, being part of this bigger war machine, the mother country's, you know, military efforts and being in this foreign country. Can you imagine? It's quite exciting if you've been born and brought up in Jamaica to suddenly cross the Atlantic and land in Guildford. You know, by the way. I do have a bit of something I talk about, and a lot of them have, Ina's got quite a distinct name, but sometimes I find I'm talking about, I get, you know, it's terrible, you can't get someone's name, it seems like I just get really in the description, and cut that bit out, really, that little bit. That's talking about names and getting names wrong. So I have an Olivia at the beginning of my book. I have this amazing woman, Olivia, who's about the only woman I could find who literally was fighting the Germans, literally, because some people have had issue with the use of the word fighting if women are non-combatants. At the beginning of the war, when they come into France and, you know, punch through with the Blitzkrieg. And then I have an Olive in my Century Girls book, and I've got the two Bettys. Oh my goodness. There's quite conventional names, and you're Olivia too.
I know. I was
There were no Phoebes. In fact, there were some brilliant names that are no longer in existence, like Primrose, Pansy.
Oh, that's a lovely name, isn't it?
Dolly. Yeah, and other, what I'm trying to think, just, and some weird men's names that we don't often hear, Leonard, and, you know, that's like sweet names, and like that have gone, and it's funny the ones that carry on going. I feel I've talked too much.
That's the whole point.
Listen to you all day, Tessa. We have unconscious. Keep going.
About
I should go and do some childcare. Yeah, being a woo man, the product of my ancient womb.
We have one final round, Tessa, that we are But this is, so it's going to be like four questions, but you just give one immediate answer to you, and we'll go straight to the next one.
First thing off the top of your head, quick fire round.
Okay, right. Who's your favourite figure in all of history?
Queen Maria of Romania.
Oh, lovely. Okay. Mm. Flip it on its head. Who's your least favourite figure in all of history?
Charles II.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, he's been on here before. Yeah.
I mean, talk about poke him if you can, even if you can't, you know? Yeah. Frankly, he's so out of fashion at the moment. He makes me feel sick.
Yeah.
It always makes me feel sick, Charles II. I just think of his big smelly willy and funny. I want to be ill. Sorry. And I know there was far more heinous individuals who conducted mass murder and did terrible things. But if you're just saying, which one actually gives me, you know, it makes my toes crawl.
Yeah, I feel the same about Henry VIII.
Like, but there's something about Henry VIII. I mean, he was so, you know, he didn't pretend to be a womanizer. He just went in there and like a top, like a big ram with an axe, you know. He was no pretense there. Whereas with Charles, I think, you know, ear of the eye and, you know, he was a bit disingenuous, I think. And funny enough, I read a very good biography about him. And I spoke to the guy, and I can't blooming well remember. It was the man. Who the hell was it who wrote it? I'm going to have to let you know so you can sub it in. But it was a while ago now. It's not a news, but in the last sort of 15, 20 years. And he said, you know, at the end of it, having spent 5 years or whatever with this man, I still felt I didn't really know him. It was so slippery. Slippery individual.
Says it all. Okay. Yeah. Next question. If you could go on a road trip with three people from history, who would you have on your car?
Again, I would have Queen Maria of Romania. She did have an open top Mercedes, and she was so popular that the peasants used to throw flowers into it. So she would be in there. Yeah. And I would also have, who would I have? Wait. I think I would have the Queen's aunt, Princess Mary, because I would want to have a bit of a crossover, and she was big in the ATS. She was the controller commandant, and I think I would understand the Queen much better.
Yeah,
and you were aunt, because I think she was a big influence on the Queen, Mary. So Mary and Marie, probably first cousins once removed, actually, so they would be fine. They could chat away among themselves, and very different. They probably wouldn't like each other. It'd be a bit awkward, because one was a bit square and like military, and Marie was flamboyant and theatrical. And then finally, I think I would have Edward Molyneux, who was the British fashion designer who had a big fashion house in Paris and who designed the Wren uniform. And he was gay, but obviously didn't come out as gay initially and was married and then ended in divorce. But he was incredible. So I'd like to ask him about that side of his life. And I think Marie would understand a bit of that. She was quite cool. And I think Mary would find it a bit awkward. And and Edward would obviously, because all three of them, he understood about the need for uniform. And he was using those kind of straight lines. He's setting the fashion really for this big war in the 30s. And I think Mary would appreciate that. And Marie loved costume and she loved fashion. So I think they'd have a big crossover. And also Marie got very sidelined at the end of her life by her horrible son, Carol II of Romania. And Edward had a tough time. He only had one eye because he was also a war hero. So I think Mary would like him. He got blinded in one eye. And then he ends up selling off his fashion houses after the Second World War because he thinks he's going blind in the other eye. In fact, it's just stress and overwork, and he's a bit lost, and he has that period in his life where he's a bit lost. In Jamaica, I think he goes. And by this time, I think he's fighting for homosexual causes. I would need to double check that. But so I think those three, will they do?
That's
perfect. Lovely. Great car.
That was incredible. Absolutely incredible for a round trip. Okay, final question for you there, because I'm conscious of your time. If you could go back in time, for one day, anywhere, where would you go to?
Oh, I would go to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. And I think I would like to be the concierge at the Ritz when Queen Marie arrives. And I would like to be there when there's this big tussle between Clemenceau and Lloyd George and Wilson. And then this Romanian queen who was upstaging all of them, who the hell was she? And I would like all that. It's like the whole of the world ascended. And if you want to understand the Second World War, you need to understand what went on at that conference. Like that was just a crazy mad conference. Literally, they were like taking out rulers and drawing lines, you know? And it's a reminder also, you know, the way in which we remember history, are you a winner or not? I think we have to remember that with your podcast on women in the war. We remember the war from the perspective of women who were on the winning side. Yeah. And that I think is, and the Paris Peace Conference, you know, really, it were the victors carving up the world, isn't it? Romania was a big winner, even though it didn't even really win in the war, it doubled in size. It was crazy decisions. We know that Germany was shrunk down. We know that all this kind of big problems and diasporas were stuck on the wrong side of borders. So I think that would be fascinating. But I also would like to know, to see, just to be in that era where suddenly it's a bit like coming out of COVID, you know, and everything's quiet and dead and tumbleweed, and there's also loads and loads, millions of dead people in the flower of their youth. But at the same time, there's extravagance and there's nations trying to show off that they're bigger and more glamorous and more glossy than other nations on the streets of Paris, which is just the perfect setting. So yeah, that's where I would go back.
Amazing.
I love it.
What a cracking set of answers there.
Absolutely brilliant. And what a way to end this.
Are you in your bedroom, Olivia? It looks like a prison cell, darling. You've got this really sinister wire coming down. It looks like you might hang yourself from it.
I'm sat on the floor because my back, even though I'm 24, my back is so bad today. I don't
is
know.
It? You got now, Betty would say, have you got a period?
I do, but also my back in general, I'm an old woman. I'm an old woman.
So you wouldn't do on the front, if we were serving on the front line right now, you might need a bit of medical assistance. Just to say, finally, the periods were a very big worry for the ATS. How do you do? In some of the interviews, girls were asked, when you have your period, does it mean you can't work?
I know.
But did they provide, do you know what the prescription for getting rid of period pain to not lose, they weren't worried about girls having period pain, they were worried about losing out days of in days of work, obviously. Exercise, the dreaded PT, physical education. So I prescribe for you, Olivia, 20 sit-ups and 50 press-ups. I think you'll be finding you feel totally fine.
Thank you. That's
for me, born in the 70s, not your third generation feminist, but doing her bit from the mid-trenches, all right, girls?
Love it. Thank you, Tessa.
Absolutely.
And that was the wonderful Tessa Dunlop talking about her new book, Army Girls. Don't forget to like, share, retweet, follow us on social media at Khaki Malarkey. We'll be with you for next week for a new episode. In the meantime, this is Khaki Malarkey signing off.